Wayne Scott, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, everybody. I'd like to thank the committee and everybody associated with this event. I have been shown tremendous kindness and hospitality. It's great to be in Big Sky Country. I haven't been here. I was asked to come to the state. The last time I was here, I was asked to leave the state, which was in 1970. They asked me to leave Missoula and keep on going. And they were right. They were right. I would have asked me to leave my state also, had I entered it. So it was so great when Tony called me and talked about the event in Montana. I went, this is just a riot, because last time I was here, I was asked to leave. So not only have I been asked to come back, but I've been just shown, again, tremendous kindness and hospitality, and I want to thank everybody. I'd like to apologize to this conference for being for wearing jeans today. I forgot to pack my suitcase. Now, it might not seem like a big thing to you, but I was asked to come here to talk about a fatal illness. And if I'm not a doctor, but if I need somebody, a doctor, to talk about a fatal illness that I have, I don't want them showing up in jeans. I don't want any doctor bounding into the hospital in a pair of Reeboks. No, I want it very formal. I want this guy to be on top of his game, really on his toes. I want him to be taking the situation very seriously. So I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that when I am participating on the group level, that I'm supposed to look a certain way. And so when I found to my horror that, and I can't blame my wife. I wish I could. You guys took that away from me. It's one of the many things I lost when I came here. She's just not interested. Just not interested. I'd like to welcome all the new people, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm with Tony. The most exciting part of any conference for me is the countdown. To see a man with 40 years, to see a guy with a couple of days, and congratulations, Jeff. You look kind of like a man who had been voted most attractive man on his cell block, kind of, when you were you look like you were honored, but you weren't real sure how honored, and you know, you know, and if you're anything like me, if you're anything like me at all and you're new, and I know there are plenty of new people here because some of you stood up, you're looking around the room right now and you're saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is lamer than church, lamer than synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. We're glad you're here. I grew up in a completely insane family in the Bronx in New York City. Yeah. Witness protection program? Is that it? See a guy named Vito on the range, you know? How do we wind up here? How do we wind up from coming to the Bronx in New York City to an Alcoholics Anonymous conference in Great Falls, Montana? We are people who would normally not mix. I think so. I think so. And my family was completely out of their minds. My wife never believed me about them until she met them. My mom threw an engagement party for us, and my wig, my aunt wore, came and she wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. It wasn't a mistake. It was a look she was going after, you know? She even kind of put it at an angle like a beret, kind of, you know? Now, anything you got in my family was stolen. Anything you got for free meant that it was stolen. And her husband was a welder, and he used to get bales of free steel wool from where he worked. And she took a decorating course, this particular aunt, and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows in the house with the steel wool. Now, after a while, that works its way through on you, you know? So when you were in their house, everybody'd be moving a little bit. There'd be a little motion, a little English on everybody in the room. I had an uncle who was one of the top 10 welterweights of the world, and I was brought up in a lower middle class Jewish home in the Bronx, and Jews don't drink. it might dull the pain. You don't want that. You don't want that. What an organization is this? This gentleman has said this beautiful prayer this morning, and invoked the name of his Savior Jesus Christ, and that works for so many people in the room. And here I am, a kid brought up in a lower middle class Jewish home in the Bronx, and here we are talking about the same disease, the same recovery. Consider each other brothers. It's what a deal. Alcoholics Anonymous, what a deal. It's really really amazing. Really amazing. My uncle was concerned about anti-Semitism. His name was Izzy Redman, and when he fought, he had a fight down in Atlanta, Georgia, and he was concerned about the anti-Semitism, so he changed his name to Izzy Goldberg, so no one would know he was Jewish. I wish I was lying about this, because this is my genetic pool. This is, these people were completely out of their minds. And just so you don't think too much has changed, my mom called me a couple of months ago and said, "Honey, I got bad news for you. Your Uncle Lizzie died." This is her brother-in-law. I said, "Oh, no, Mom. When did he pass on?" She said, "A year ago." I said, "What?" She said, "Oh, well, you know, I haven't been picking up the phone very much because your Aunt Phyllis is back in the mental institution and she calls me and harasses me, but it's okay. Phyllis died a couple of weeks ago, so I've been feel comfortable enough to pick the phone up again." And one of the first calls they've been trying to reach her for a year is that Izzy died. And here's the deal, newcomers. All I got is good news for you. My insane family had not one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. I'm not saying I didn't get messed up. I'm not saying there weren't problems. I'm not saying that things didn't have to get worked on. But I protect my right to vomit. I don't know about you. I get excited when I'm told I need dental surgery. All right. Normal people don't get excited when they're told they need dental surgery. That's an uninterrupted source of painkillers for a period of time. You know, normal people don't go, dental surgery. They don't know. They don't get a little shot of adrenaline, you know. And by the way, you know you're in an AA meeting when people laugh at dental surgery. You know? They don't get a laugh on that in a Lions Club ever. No matter how much I work on my family problems, I will never, ever be anything but an alcoholic. Never. I can't go to therapy. It does not matter how much I work on my family problems. I am not saying don't go to therapy. I am not saying don't work on your family problems. I'm saying for me, it doesn't matter how much of that work I do. For the rest of my life, I'll still have to go to parties and say, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier. I'll be doing that until the day I die. No matter how much I work on that stuff, it just doesn't matter. And that is a perplexing thing. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. And I was on the brink of being a very well-analyzed corpse by the time I got there. I was going to be dead with no Oedipal conflict at all. But but really dead. And it's perplexing because I did good work in therapy. I really did. But I was dying. It's a very bizarre disease, newcomers. If you don't have alcoholism and you're here, I didn't have it when I got here. They're going to lie to you and tell you you can't catch it. They're lying to you. I caught alcoholism from you guys at these meetings. You have given me alcoholism. I don't know, you know, and I got a bad case of it, of alcoholism. And it's a disease, totally bizarre and unique disease, which is good news for anyone with an ego the size of mine. I don't mind having a... if you don't catch it, you die from it, and if you catch it, you get better from it. It's pretty strange. So I grew up in this insane family in the Bronx, and I joined a gang in the Bronx, young rocket scientists I got involved in were fond of stealing cars and running them into each other until they wouldn't move anymore. So I was being inducted into this group, and they're in a circle around me, and this guy George is bringing me into the gang. He said, "Look, this is the deal. We only do Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes, all right? That's all we do. Because you knock the fly window out, you get into the car, and the ignition's got off, on, and lock. Take your house key, take it out. If it's on lock, shine the car. Go find another car. If it's on off, put your key in, turn it on, drive off." And I looked around real cocky, and I went,
What if it's on? He said, if it's on, someone's in the car. Right? Take a hike. I failed the gang 101. I was asked to leave the gang and never be, but I found some guys who were taking drugs and wearing strange clothes, and I immediately gravitated to them. And because if there was one thing I was sure of, it's that I wasn't an alcoholic, even at that early age, because I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And then I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana, which gets old after a while. Wow. What? I kicked marijuana with pills, and I overcame pills with heroin, and you don't want to do heroin for too long, because at first you're kind of colorful and interesting and adventurous, and then you're just a disgusting pig who vomits. And I triumphed over heroin with cocaine, and cocaine's a great drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I unloaded, I stopped that cocaine with alcohol. And then I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and this is the way I stayed okay, by swapping addictions and never lighting on one too long. But I didn't know that I had the disease of alcoholism. My father thought that he was a complete failure, and I absolutely agreed with him. I thought he was a flop, and my dad never made more than $10,000 a year, and my brother and I never missed a meal and never went to school with ripped clothing. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children did go to school with ripped clothing, and they did miss meals. How had my father become a loser in my mind? How had that happened? Look at the numbers. How had that happened? It had happened because a certain kind of thinking had become established in me that had placed me beyond human help. That totally illogical point of view, that bizarre twist of perspective, that it would allow me, despite the facts of how my brother and I were treated and the facts of how my children were treated, I could look at them side by side and decide that my father was a loser. That is a remarkable thing. That is, newcomers, what we call alcoholic thinking. For me, my favorite example, one of my favorite examples of alcoholic thinking, I heard at my home group some years ago. A guy had been dragged out of his car by the cops, and he was loaded, and he was chained to a bench in a police station. He had just urinated on himself, and he looked up at the police and said, "I've got to stop driving." When the drink in your hand has no connection to the condition of your life, that's fatal alcoholic denial. That'll kill you dead. And that's what happened to me over that period of time. My sponsor early on, he said, "Scott, this is a threefold deal here. This disease attacks us on the physical level, on the mental level, and ultimately on the spiritual level." And he said to me, "If you want to take a look at that and find out more about the deal with the physical portion of the disease, please pick up our book and read the doctor's opinion." It was written by a non-alcoholic, a man who did not have alcoholism, and he describes in this section a class of people apart from normal people, a class of people who experience something called the phenomenon of craving, who drink not because they want to, but because they have to, who have every reason in the world to stay sober, and yet they drink, despite all the reality around them and their needs, wants, and desires, and the needs, wants, and desires of their families. He describes alcoholics whose problems pile up at a seemingly unsolvable rate, and they of themselves cannot help the situation. They're crushed under the weight of it, and they drink over and over and over again, and they cannot get out of the loop. And this is something that's always just really had a tremendous effect on me. In this section of the book, he says, "Why would I do this? I'm the administrator of one of the most prestigious institutions dedicated to the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction in the United States. Why would I sponsor an altruistic spiritual society that I do not make $1 on? Why would I possibly do that?" And then he says, "If you don't get it, come with me. Come work with me. Hear the sound of a man who wants to stop drinking and who can't. See the warped families, the destroyed marriages, the destroyed children." And then he says something, and it never fails to hit me in my heart. He says, "Let it become part of your waking hours and your sleeping hours." He was dreaming about it. And he said, you will not ask me why I'm doing this thing. So you might want to take a look at that section of the book. And then if you want to get into this this thing about this alcoholic thinking, you might want to take a look at the second and third chapters of our book. Newcomers, if you've been drinking at exactly the wrong time, if you build up a bright outlook for yourself and your family and rip it down around your ears in a senseless series of sprees, if you fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, or a second ago, you could have alcoholism. If you don't, what is wrong with you? What's your problem, man? What is your story? What? If you don't have alcoholism, consider the alternatives. Really, what do you have? If that's what's happening to you, if you go out for a pack of cigarettes and wind up in Baltimore, you know, my wife and I had been smoking pot to go to sleep every night for 15 years, and I was upset about it. My doctor said, well, I'll give you these pills, you know, that'll help. It's chlorohydrate, which is, you know, chlorohydrate is what they slip into sailors' drinks to knock them out, and the film is made in the 30s. Well, you don't want to waste a good pill like that and go to sleep, so I take a handful and smash my head into the wall to stay awake during it. But the problem was that they made me incontinent. I'd wet the bed at night, which was... Now, here's alcoholic thinking. My wife and I considered it a personal triumph when I started standing and urinating on the wall. That was a good night for us. It showed I was trying. Oh my God! The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. I mean, Nancy came home one day and I had decided to cook something, but I just had a hard time, and I went down in the middle of the idea, you know. And she came in and I was laying on the floor holding a frying pan, and she found this empty vial of pills, and she called the doctor. And the doctor said, "Well, call the paramedics." She said, "But the police will come. Call the paramedics. But the neighbors." She hung up the phone and called another doctor for a second opinion. So this alcoholic thinking is not exclusive to the alcoholic. It starts to become pervasive through the entire family. And Dr. Silkworth talks about it. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. Well, at any rate, once this physical allergy is mixed with this bizarre thinking, it seems to cause a sickness of the soul, a cancer of the soul, that eats alcoholics up from the inside like a tapeworm and leaves them hollow and alone and hopeless and baffled. Their lives slip out between their fingers like a handful of water over and over and over again. And of themselves, they can do nothing about it. And newcomers, if you want to take a look at the description of that sickness and the solution, you might want to take a look at chapter 4. The solution begins real, real clearly in the following chapter, chapter 5. But chapter 4 is really amazing. It says, all it's got is good news. It says, you have faith. You don't have to worry about faith. You know, if you're there and you're worried that you can't believe, you know, we would put forward to you, you have tremendous faith and have had tremendous faith for years in alcohol, people, places, and things. And all we're going to do is we're going to give you a kit of spiritual tools that are going to move your eyes. They're going to move that faith from something that's killing you to something that's going to save your life. That's all we're going to do. Right? And it says there, and Jeff, this is part of what I want to tell you this morning. It says, if you believe now or are even willing to believe, you don't have to believe. If you're even willing to believe, that's a pretty big hoop to jump through. It doesn't say belly up and pay your dues. It doesn't say we're going to haze you. It says we emphatically assure you you're on your way. You're in. You're in, man. You hit the floor running. You're on the bus. You know, and nobody can tell you different, according to our traditions. That's a pretty remarkable thing. And then chapters 5, 6, and 7. Talk about the specific work we're asked to do here to get better. After kind of getting through my adolescence, I was going through one of my periods of using hypodermic needles, and I don't mean to offend anybody. This is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but I got to tell my story, and I only have the one. It's kind of interesting to show up with another one. I was a small Polynesian woman when I got here. I'm an overweight Jewish man today. As a result of the steps, I mean. and I had gotten loaded. I shot some dope, and my father had a massive stroke, and he passed away that night. And I couldn't be there for him or my mother or my brother. I couldn't be there for my father the night he died because I was loaded. And I felt like a pig, like an animal. I've never, ever remembered feeling like I felt that morning. And I swore I'd never put a needle in my arm again, and I didn't. And that was something I couldn't even think about. I couldn't cope with thinking about what how I had comported myself as a son, as a son to my father, as a son to my mother, as a brother to my brother. And I felt like something less than human. And I didn't know why, and I just went back to therapy. You know. And sometime after this, I met a remarkable woman, just an extraordinary woman. I was acting in a Broadway show. I was kind of playing a Hell's Angel at the time, and this new usherette with brown hair came into the theater, and I took one look at her, and I walked back into the dressing room of this theater, and I got up on a chair, and I said, if anyone talks to the new usherette with brown hair, I'll break all the bones in your body, man. And she saw in my little biography in the program that I was a filmmaker, and she walked in the next day with a big book that said Orson Welles on it, you know, and sat in the back row so I could strike up a conversation with her. And we absolutely were mad for each other. Now, I had set some pretty lofty goals for myself when I was a young man, because as I told you, my father was a loser and I wasn't going to wind up like him. And by the time I got to AA, I had reached or passed all of these goals. I had a book on, I had had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a movie. I directed a TV show. I had my own theater in New York. And I had done all of these things a ton. I never got to do any of them more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business, so I couldn't find them again. Because people were horrible to me. Horrible. And when I took the alcoholic test, we have a test for alcoholism newcomers. It's a call-in inventory. Everyone passes. All you got to do is take it. It's a pass situation. And it's the only picture of alcoholism we have. We don't get x-rays and blood tests, all that. We just get an inventory, and that'll give you an idea of what it looks like. And sometimes guys I sponsor, you know, they write a little, and they say, geez, can I come over and read some of it? And I say, you know, I try to encourage them not to. I try to encourage them, listen, if you could come over and do the whole thing, take a look at the whole thing. You might take a look at the whole mess. I'm resentful at them. I'm resentful at me for resenting them. I'm resentful at them for watching me resent them. Right? And I've had sex with all of them, you know? The web! It's extraordinary I ever got out of bed. If you could take a look at the whole thing, you might just be so crushed under the weight of it that you might be so deflated of ego at depth that you could stick around here. You could be so convinced that your plan has failed you utterly that you could possibly stick around here. So if you had written down everything I had done in 8 years of marriage and given it to this woman and said, would you, you know, read it and would you live with this? Oh, no reasonable human being would live with it. But you spread it out over 8 years. Throw in chronic success, throw in a best-selling book, throw in the fact that when I started to walk to the drink, quite often I was telling the truth. Got a little murky over here. It was quite often an out-and-out lie by the time I got over here. But it was quite often the truth over here, you know. Yeah, you'd live with it. It'll make you sick and insane and it'll chip away at you. And Nancy and I became grievously ill together. We got so sick. A guy lent us his car, and we sold the car. We sold this guy's car. He lent us the car. I'll never forget this guy's voice on the phone. He said, "You sold my car? I lent you my car." That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow, you know? And you're proud of what you did, you know? I did the right thing. I said to him, you know, well, rent was due and we were sick acting like kids, immature kids. I didn't want to borrow money again. I said to Nancy, honey, let's do the right thing. Let's sell the car. Oh my God. The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. When I called this guy years later to pay him back, his voice hadn't changed a bit. He said, "You're paying me back?" It was like he was frozen on the phone for about 15 years. Man, strange mental twist. Came home one day, we had these 32-ounce tumblers, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine and emptied the entire bottle of wine in one of these cups. And I turned around, and Nancy was giving me the rat face. I said, "What?" She said, "What are you doing?" And completely seriously, I looked her in the eyes, and I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? I had to work in a coffee house for a while in New York, and I stole an immense amount of money from my employer because I wasn't going to be treated like a sap and a sucker like my father. So I wasn't going to let this guy, you know, take advantage of me by paying me an honest day's wage for an honest day's work. So I stole a tremendous amount of money from, and Nancy and I went on a belated honeymoon to Italy. Feeling I had done the right, I'm a stand-up guy. I'm not going to be a sap like my old man. So we're in a medieval village in the Italian Alps, in a cafe. Pretty amazing, right? Pretty amazing place to be. Probably be enough for a normal person. They make cognac right there. There's a cognac, and it's a couple of bucks a fifth. I'm knocking off a couple of bottles a day, and one night after dinner, I drank a whole bottle of cognac. I turn around, and I'm getting the rat face again, you know? I said, "What?" She said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, honey, this cognac, they make it right here. This is fresh. They made it. They make it a couple of days. This hasn't had the time to develop the alcohol content, but, you know, the stuff in the Come on. It's fresh cognac. What are you going to do, argue with that? What are you going to do? She threw her hands up and said, "What a moron." And I looked at her and said, "What an idiot." You know, we said this to ourselves. And became sicker and sicker. We had two children, two remarkable children, who both of them became grievously ill from alcoholism. My older son was diagnosed as being functionally retarded. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, he was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making. He was crippled up, reading and writing years below his grade level, cut off from the society of other children, crushed up and alone and weird. Fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. The fabric of our lives is shot through with it, and how horribly true for the young people who are exposed to alcoholism. Because nothing ever winds up the way it's supposed to wind up, ever, no matter what, because I'm going to have to take the walk to the drink. If you're in between me and the drink, I'm going to get to the drink. I'm going to get to it. Might not be right away, but I will get to it. And I'm either going to walk through you or around you. And at some point, you're going to have to disappear. No matter how much I love you, no matter how much responsibility I have toward you, you're going to have to become transparent. How much can a child take? How much disappearing can a child take before he or she says, "I have no substance. I don't matter. I'm invisible." It's horrible. And it happens slowly over a period of time. It's like standing on the, you know, on the beach as the waves are coming back and the sand just keeps grinding out from underneath your feet. And the kids get sicker and sicker and sicker. And that's what happened to my family, to our family, by the time I got to AA. And I was in and out of show business in Los Angeles. I was working as a screenwriter and a television director. And my careers kept exploding in my face. And people were doing me wrong. And the kids were getting more insane. And the money was getting thinner and thinner. I started going into my final stages. I overdosed a couple of times and wound up in a county facility in Los Angeles. And we moved to Los Angeles about 13 and a half years ago. We had been living in New York. 2 years before we moved, we had our first son. And we had him in a hospital in New York, and we were surrounded by friends. We were surrounded by family. We were smothered with gifts, we were smothered with love, and 2 years and 9 months later, when we had our second son, there was nobody at the hospital, there were no phone calls, there were no gifts, we were totally alone. We were suffering from untreated alcoholism, we didn't even have it. Sometime after this, I put a needle in my arm. I crossed a line I swore I'd never cross again. And I called my therapist of record that morning. I told him what I had done, and he said, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." I said, "What?" He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can do is suggest is that you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. Now, on most other mornings, I would have gladly chosen the institution, far more than Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it would have been a chance to meet some more adventurous, colorful people, the kinds of people I was used to associating with. But I went to an AA meeting, I don't know why. I went to one AA meeting, I came home and poured myself a glass of wine, and Nancy said, I'm getting the rat face, man, you know, one more time. And then she said, what are you doing? I said, honey, these people aren't fanatics. You know, you have a glass of wine like a civilized human being, they just don't get drunk. But you don't completely swear off, you know, alcohol for the rest of your life. And I went to a second meeting, and I had already sent some money to Texas for some drugs, so they arrived. They were already paid for. So it was I had to take them. It was incumbent upon me to take them. And it was a new drug called ecstasy. And a little murmur went through the crowd. And it was an incredible drug. I didn't even feel Jewish when I took it. I mean, it was absolutely astounding feeling. But it wears off. You know, it wears off. But when I took it hit me, I went, oh man, I'm not going to need that AA thing, you know, this is great, you know, and it wears off, you know. And I went home to the sick wife and the sick kids and the destroyed life, the crippled family, and the next morning at 7 a.m., I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I put on my best clothes, I got you a bad check to write you, and I went down to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked around the room. I said, no. They've all got one tooth and it's got a cavity in it, man. Oh, no. I'm a major guy. How can I be an Alcoholics Anonymous? And, you know, if you're new here, you are now privy to an unending, unsolicited reservoir of information and advice, you know. They're going to talk to you, man. They are going to talk to you, you know. And if you're anything like me, the kind of bully I am, I'm a nice guy. I'm a sterling human being. That's my first shot. So I would listen, and I'd grin, and I would nod, and I would pray that their face would burst into flame. You know, they'd just go up in a column of smoke and leave me alone. Because I'm an alcohol. Isn't it bad enough that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I stuck around. I have no idea why I did. If you're new here, I hope you're out of plans. I think I was out of plans. If you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use the plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us the plan. We want to know the plan. but don't use the plan. That's actually the book I've always wanted to see, The Collection of Newcomer Plans. There'd be some blueprints in there, too, you know, some diagrams. So I don't know why I stuck around. I hated you. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. My life was over. I was 6 months sober. I was receiving the gift of step none. And I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. You know, I tell you, I've had such an incredible weekend and had the opportunity to hear such incredible speakers. And I loved Terry's talk, and I loved everyone's talk, Penny's and Mary Pearl's and Sharon and June's. And one of the things I loved that Terry talked about, I loved to hear him talk about his sponsor. I just loved it because he feels about his sponsor the way I feel about mine. And it's an amazing thing. If you listen to the things he was saying, there wasn't one thing that Terry said that his sponsor did or does for him that a human being can't do. There's nothing in there. Everything my sponsor has done for me, I've been able to do for another man. You know, no matter what I think, no matter what I think I'll never be the spiritual Goliath he is, or, you know, whatever is there. This is such a simple, non-mystical, concrete, you know, nuts and bolts program. There's nothing that's been passed on to me that I can't take to another man. And I just love to hear him talk about that. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. I didn't even know I had alcoholism yet, so I didn't know that. And alcoholism, untreated alcoholism, is an ugly, ugly thing. I find it particularly unattractive in people who are not drinking. You can pick them out at the meetings. They usually have a vein pumping like a garden hose on their forehead. You know? And you can count all the tendons in their neck. They're a happy lot. real relaxed, happy Jurassic World. Man.
You see, at least the guys who are drinking, they're treating their alcoholism. It's a treatment that works. It kills you, but it works. You know, and if you're not using that, and you're not using the program of action outlined in our book, we don't have a monopoly on spiritual experience, but if you're in the grip of this deal, and that's not happening for you, man, is it ugly. And that's the state I was in when I came to my sponsor. Part of my face was moving in a different direction, man. I looked like I'd walked out of the GM wind tunnel, you know. And I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He talked about God. He didn't sound like a sucker to me. And he took me over to his apartment that afternoon, and all hell broke loose. That afternoon, he addressed every problem I have ever had or every problem I will ever have. He addressed them that afternoon. He addressed my hatred of myself, my hatred of you, my overwhelming fears, and my unsolvable sexual problems. He addressed them, didn't solve them, but addressed them all that afternoon. Now, you hear sometimes people say, and I believe them, that they mainly resented themselves. Well, I resented myself, but I really hated you. I hated you way more than I hated me. I'm not a suicide guy. I'm a homicide guy. I vastly prefer your death to mine. You know, I always have. And I figure if I kill all of you, there'll be no reason to commit suicide. But I respect the suicide people. I do. I'm not putting them down. It's kind of like the flip side of the same coin in a way. But I've always been much more partial to homicide than suicide. So I had no problem relating to my resentments to other people. And my sponsor that afternoon worked steps 1, 2, and 3 with me, which were taken for me on a real primitive level. The level that I took step 1 on to begin with was much more primitive than I was able to take it on by the time I did my inventory. Admit unmanageability? Well, look at an inventory. I mean, that drove it home for me. It was an intellectual exercise until I did an inventory, you know? A friend of mine who's carried his light into another room used to love to tell this story at our home group, and I'll tell a few tonight. His name was Bill W., and he was from London, and he was an incredible guy, and he loved to tell this story. He said, tell the story about an old-timer, grabbed a newcomer, took him on a 12-step call. They went down this country road, it was a dirt road, until they reached this lean-to with no doors, just a burlap sack, and they went inside, and this drunk is in his underwear, and he's sitting on a stained mattress, sucking on a bottle of wine. There's a little candle in a can, and the newcomer looks around and says, look, I'm new. I don't know much about this thing, but I will tell you one thing for sure. If you keep drinking, you're going to lose all this. So, whatever level I was taking step one on, by the time I took my inventory, it was on a deeper level, and by the time I started doing 12-step work, it was on a much deeper level. For me, those first three steps, I have to take them as well as I can to begin with, but if I don't move on with the rest of the program, they're going to get pretty thin for me. I've heard one fifth step, it took a man 20 hours to read, and I've heard one fifth step, it took a man 15 minutes to read. They're both drunk. They didn't do the rest of the work. They didn't do the rest of the work. They couldn't maintain it. The third step will have little permanent or lasting effect unless immediately followed by a fourth. And the way it seems, the fourth will have little permanent or lasting effect unless maintained by 9, 10, 11, and 12. So he gave me instructions in that fourth step, and I took 3 months. I wrote it. I came over to his place, and I read it. And he gave me instructions in step 6 and 7, which have kind of become my template for my relationship with God. And it came time to do my 8-step list. And newcomers, I want to give you the best reading of the 8th step I've ever heard in my life. It happened at my old home group, and it was done by a guy who I've never seen, had never seen before, and I've never seen him since. His name is Nino. He had a heavy New York accent. He's from New York, and he was there with a hospital group. He had a hospital bracelet on, and he had never read chapter 5 before. And he was asked to read chapter 5 that night. He's reading chapter 5, and he's reading the steps, and he gets up to step 8, and he says, made a list of all those we had harmed that became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen this? Do you have any idea what's in here? The reason why I mention this to you is it because that's all I saw when I saw the steps? It's all I saw. No! No! Not those people. Not that money. I wouldn't have taken that much money. No! No! Not the car! So if you knew, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are right now. And it's 8, you know 9's going to get you. Don't worry about 8. 8's a walk in the country compared to 9. Man. So I did that 8-step list, and I didn't want to put my dad down there. He's dead. And my sponsor said, "Do you owe him an amends?" I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "Well, you put him down there." Now, I had heard some people in the fellowship go to the grave and say, "I'm sorry," and I'm not putting them down, please. This is not an indictment of anybody else's program. This is just how I have found the God that has saved my life. It was very clear to me that I couldn't do that. That I had been so dramatic and so, I'm sorry were the two most useless words in my vocabulary. But I could not do that, and I was confused, and my sponsor said, "I tell you what, you do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's see what happens. You do your job. Let's see what happens," you know? And, you know, it's so great that the theme here is the promises. I was always, you know, you hear this in meetings sometimes, and again, I know some people have to do this, and I'm not putting them down. But I heard it at a meeting. It sounded pretty good to me. I said to my sponsor, "Shouldn't I put myself on the top of that 8-step list?" He said, "Yeah, you've never, ever done anything for yourself. I think it would be wise to do that. You've always put other people's wishes and desires before yours." He said, "If you're on the list, be on the bottom of the list. How's that?" Now, the promises come true halfway through 9. We're to know a new peace, a new freedom. We're to know serenity. We're going to get relief from fear of financial insecurity. I'm going to be able to deal with situations that used to baffle me. "Sorry, Father, that's not quite enough. I need to make some amends to myself." That's just what happened for me. He said, "Well, let's say the promises will be enough for you, that you don't need to be on the list," because it is a pretty powerful package we're given halfway through 9, and it's just sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, they'll always materialize if we work for them. Not if I want them real hard, if I work for them. And I'm never to pray for anything for myself, only for others. And this is such a wonderful sense. It says, "I will be paid and then in great kind." My favorite description of step 11 is in Bill's story, where he talks about turning to the Father of Light who presides over all. A great price had to be paid, and it was the destruction of self. It's such a wonderful description of that step. So I put my father on my inventory, on my 8-step list. I put my wife and children down there, and it was also very clear to me I couldn't sit down with my children and go, "Geez, sorry, boys." I had to do it 40 Little League games later. 40 flag football games later, 50 homework assignments later. I had to spend a lot of heroin money on toys. I had to spend a lot of cocaine money on trips. I had to do a lot of stuff before I believed I'm sorry. Before I could sit down and say I'm sorry and mean it with my whole body. Now, there were some people I just had to go, you know, the guy whose car I stole didn't care if I meant it. He wanted his money. He wasn't in the sincerity market by that time. But with my family, it was a real different thing. And once I started doing this work, my family came into contact with someone in whom their problem had been solved, and that person was me. And my wife reached out and began to reach out to the Al-Anon family groups, and I will tell you, and it's just for me again, it's all for me, it's just my opinion and my experience. One of the most confusing things for me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard people making jokes about Al-Anon, and they weren't good-natured jokes, they were mean jokes, and I found them very hurtful and very, very confusing, because I said, "Hold it, isn't this a good thing? Isn't this one of our goals, for the family to come back together?" And I realized the people who were making those jokes were completely ignorant of Al-Anon and the way it worked. That was just my experience and the people who I came into contact with. And again, I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. God knows we make enough fun of ourselves, you know. And plus, I was really proud of my wife. I was really proud of this valiant attempt she was making of getting closer to this thing that was saving my life, you know. And Nancy really, really started working an Al-Anon program, and our family started getting closer to the light. I fancied myself a show business big shot, and About a year sober. My neck is driving me crazy. Strange bit. About a year sober, I got a job directing a situation comedy on TV in Los Angeles, and I almost drank over it. I almost drank over it because I wasn't going there to bring anything. I was going there to take something. And it started becoming my God again. And I almost drank. I called my sponsor. I did my 10-step on it. And he said, you ready? And I said, yeah, I'm ready. And I said my prayer. I said, Father, this too. You get this too, show business is yours. Within 3 months, I was working on a catering truck. And I looked up and I said, I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. I definitely did not mean this. Now, in Los Angeles, if you're catering, feeding people on a TV or a movie set, that's a Teamster's job. That is good dough, man. You're like breaking a racketeering law, probably, but it's really, really good dough. All right? But I can't appreciate that because I'm Scott Redden. Right? So the first movie that I cater, the executive producer and the star of the movie is a guy who I've worked with in the industry as a professional. And he sticks his head on a catering truck that morning and he says, can I have a burrito? Scott? And I said, what's happening, man? He said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. Oh, man. I went nuts. I called my sponsor. You know when you're on the phone with your sponsor, you sound like a man falling off a bridge trying to finish before he hits the ground, you know? Because you know he's heaved the phone across the room and he's folding his laundry by that time. This is the gift. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the gift. Humiliation, pain. You know, I mean, I was out of my mind. He said, sounds like you've got a resentment. Where do they come up with this stuff, Terry? It's unbelievable. You better sit down and write yourself a 10-step. This is the way my AA family does it. You know, every AA family has a different way, and this is the way my family does it. You sit down and you write, I am resentful of Scott for working on a catering truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What do I ask God to remove? The catering truck? The guy who saw me? No. What is blocking me? What is killing me? Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual sickness. The great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll take you out, cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, kill your ass dead, but don't be alarmed. No big deal. I mean, I'm in trouble. I'm in serious trouble with this soul sickness if I don't do something about it. What is blocking me? What are the defects of character in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Grandiose. How dare a man of my caliber be working on a catering truck and feeding his family? I'm not trusting in God. I'm playing God. Things aren't going to, according to the Scott Redman program, a fabulous program. I'm impatient. Things aren't moving along at the proper rate. I'm ungrateful. I got a great job, man. I'm making great dough. I have false pride. Low self-esteem. This is the list I had to go to God with. And then I had to ask the biggest question I've ever asked in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to say, Father, what can I do for you? Please take this away. Please take this away. I'll do your work. What, you do my work. What can I do for you to let you in here? What service can I do? What can I do? And if it won't go away, and it didn't go away, because I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors, actors who I... And I'll tell you the worst thing that happened to me. Well, the next to worst. This actor comes out. I directed this actor in a soap opera, right? He's coming down the line. I've been working the steps. I'm a spiritual behemoth. Getting ready to have my humility moment. He's coming. I'm poised. I'm not hiding. I'm a man of God. I'm walking with God. I serve the man. He doesn't recognize me. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't. I was all, you know, man, I was ready for it. No, I'm fine. I'm happy. I was just a schmuck with a ladle is what I was, so. When this thing didn't go away, and I kept resenting myself for it, resenting these other people. I mean, I had to write a resentment against this guy for asking for the burrito. For what? The guy was not nice to me. Well, he was hungry. I mean, he didn't do anything. He didn't rub it in. He was a sweetheart, you know? So it says in our book, when we're trying to do the sixth and seventh step, it says, first of all, we've got to ask God to remove him. Now, it's been my experience that when a man asks like this, please take him away, you miserable son of a bitch. Or if he says, take him away if you can, big guy. God's not interested in fighting with me. And I'm learning how to take step three. I'm learning how to turn my will and my life over. Otherwise, I just say, Father, I'm yours. He says, oh, thanks. Thanks. I'm God. I had a feeling you were mine, but that's awfully big of you. Thanks for the gesture. Very kind of you. What do you mean? Well, this is what I mean. Take this away. Please, let me turn this over to you. This is my life. This is the spiritual poison. This is the spiritual health. This is the whole nine yards. And it says, go over the first five propositions in the book, if it's not going away, and ask yourself, are you making mortar without sand? This horrible false pride won't leave me, and it's killing me on the job as a caterer. Is it step one? Am I not really admitting this is unmanageable? Is it step two? Have I not really come to believe that God will take this? Do I not trust my God to take this? Is my God not big enough to handle this? And if he's not, what can I do to make him bigger? What act of faith can I do? What service can I do to make my God big enough to handle this? My sponsor used to say to me, you use my God till yours is big enough. One of those things. And I, just like Terry Mann, I have been able to look into a man's eyes and tell him that and see it well up in him. Because he has seen it in me. He has seen the demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, the most unintellectual program in the world, because it's based on demonstration, not on talk. Based on it. And so I went through catering and getting okay with it and doing the 10th step, and my sponsor said, Scott, I want you to learn how to give these people a dime for their nickel. And I did, and I worked real hard on it, and I got free, and both of the companies that I cooked for eventually asked me to go into business with them. And around a couple of years into this, I was approached by a company called Ketchum Public Relations, and they offered me a really big writing job, comedy writing job, and it would have gotten me back on back in the high life again. And man, I wanted this. I really wanted it. And I started obsessing on it. And I went mad. I went mad, got totally obsessed, couldn't turn, and I crashed and burned before I even heard, and I had made a kind of a videotape for him, an audition tape, and before I even heard whether or not I got the job, I went bananas, I did the 10th step, I cleared it, I read it to my sponsor, humbled myself, got the service, and got free. Shortly after this, I get a phone call from Ketchum Public Relations. They say, you didn't get the job, and I was fine. I hang up the phone rings again, can you go up to Lake Arrowhead, it's near LA, and cater a commercial? I said, absolutely. I jump in the catering truck, get up to Lake Arrowhead, and I grab the call sheet, and who's the commercial for? It's for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Not only am I feeding them, but they are shooting a video of the making of the commercial. So they are now videotaping my humiliation. So they're going to go back to New York with the videotape, and the guys in New York are going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf there? What? Geez, if we'd only known, you know, we would have given him something. So I am now bananas. I call my sponsor and I go, here's the gift again, the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I'm so happy. Oh, so happy. He says, well, I guess God had enough writers, he needed a few cooks today. I'm going to tell him you booed him. Then he said to me, well, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, you just didn't tell him what job. Sometime after this, I got a phone call from a couple of people I had never talked to before, and they said, look, we've heard your story, and we understand you've had a spiritual awakening. Our kid goes to school with your kid, and we'd heard your story from some people, and we're sick of writing with crazy people. Will you come write with us? We understand that you're walking a spiritual path. I don't know how much clearer the message can get than that. And as a direct result of that phone call, I have my own production company, and I write and direct TV shows and movies. And the only reason I mention that to you is because I asked God if I could have a dream, if I could continue writing, and he said, fine. And I wrote every day when I got home from work. the fact that I'm able to make a living at it again is just, that's bread and butter. It happened to me again once I didn't need it anymore, once it had ceased to become my God. But you know, I could have an attack of false humility and not share my success with you. Why would I want to do that? I've shared my humiliations with you this morning. No reason in the world why I shouldn't share my success with you. And when I was kind of new, I was online to buy lunch, and this guy in front of me was buying a can of Colt 45 malt liquor with, you know, change and lint, and, you know, he had been there for a week. And he turned around and he looked at me and he said, what are you looking at? And I said, well, how you doing? He said, you don't know how I'm doing. Nobody knows how I'm doing except for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we went outside and we exchanged numbers and I bought the guy some food, and later that night he called me and I went on my first real 12-step call. I was pretty new, and I got a guy with more time than me, and we took him down to County General Hospital. It's a county facility. It's a pit in Los Angeles, and people said, just take him down and dump him off at the door. Don't go in with him. Just dump him off at the door and book. Don't show them that he has any ways and means or money or anything. Just go. We went through the whole deal with him. I don't know why. We went through all the way up through the alcoholic ward with the guy. And about halfway through, he turns to us and he says, I feel like I'm dying. And the guy I'm with says, that's because you are. And I said, what a terrible thing to say to this guy. What a cold, insensitive thing. How could you do that? And the guy I'm with says, oh, the guy is, he's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break his way into the alcoholic ward of a county facility. What am I supposed to say? You're just having a bad day? This is just a bad break? No. This isn't a bad day. This is what dying feels like. This is exactly what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. Sometime after this, a guy who I sponsor called me up and said, look, you know, don't talk to me about the steps and, you know, blow up. You know, leave me alone and take a hike. And he cut me loose and proceeded to rip some people off in the program. He stole some money and he stole a car and he ripped off an apartment, and he was making me look pretty bad. You know, and I wanted to sit him down and explain a few things to him. You know, my sponsor said, I don't think so. You've been telling people where they stand in the universe your whole life, you know. I think you better sit down and you better write yourself a resentment out. I'm resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A little ego blow, a little knock in the crotch there, right? What are the defects of character in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Well, self-centered. I care more about how I look than what the guy's going through. I didn't steal any money, you know. Impatient. I'm impatient with his recovery. Spiritual pride, that's a new one. I didn't get that until I came into AA and became a spiritual behemoth, right? How could this guy comport himself thusly after coming into contact with a man of my spiritual caliber? Unbelievable. And I'm unwilling to accept the fact that another child of God could be spiritually sick like me. It says in our book that if a man is spiritually sick, if I can accept his spiritual illness, I'd show him the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant the sick friend. I certainly wouldn't be mad at him. So clearly, if I'm resentful at this guy, one of the defects has got to be I'm unwilling to accept his spiritual illness. So I did that 10th step, and sometime after this, this guy found out that he was dying. He had a fatal illness, and he called the city agency, and they said, all we can do is take you down to County General Hospital and dump you off at the door. And I knew that that wasn't true because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he couldn't call anybody else because I guess the other people in his life had told him what they thought of him, or he had just burnt them all out. I was the last guy he could call. So I got to be there for another man during his death when I couldn't be there for my father. And my father came back into my life. And I felt his presence again. And I had him back. And I could tell his grandchildren about him. And my kids could laugh about him. And that horrible, cold place that all I could do was just wince when it came up was absolutely gone. And I had my dad back and continue to have him back. You know, they tell us that we're not bad people getting good, we're sick people getting well, and that's true. But I will tell you something. I might not have been a bad guy, but I did an awfully good imitation of one, you know. And I wanted to be a good guy when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor is a good guy, and he acts like a good guy. And the guys I hang out with are good guys. And I like that. And I like being a good guy. And I could never, as long as that wall was up between me and my dad, I never felt like a good guy. What's happened in my family is
a pretty remarkable thing. My wife and I have celebrated 17 years of marriage, and first 8 years were a suicide pact, and now we have a marriage, and we don't work on our relationship anymore. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. You know, until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, you know. And on the way down you go, okay. we have a couple of, I guess about a year ago, we were having some financial difficulty. We were the only people in the United States who were having financial difficulty. And I started feeling pretty bad, and my wife sat me down and she looked at me in the eyes and she said, you know, you're my guy. You're absolutely perfect for me, and I love you, and I love you perfectly just the way you are. I didn't marry a rich guy. I married you, and I adore you. That's what you've done to us. You know. My children, the child who was functionally retarded 8.5 years ago, last year graduated to one of the one of the most prestigious scholastic programs for junior high school students in the United States, and he entered one of the most prestigious high school students, scholastic programs for high school students in the United States. He is a lead singer in a rock and roll band. He's basking in the sunlight of the Spirit. Now, I'm not telling you if you're new that if you get sober, your marriage is going to come together and your kids are going to get well. I will tell you that you will be available if it takes place. I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. If my kids got better or if they didn't get better, I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. My children have found an entire class of adults who is frightened of them. It's the new men who come to my house. And a couple of years ago, Jesse was about 8, and a new guy came over, and Jesse walked up to him and said, what step you working, pal? He said, 4, 4, I'm on 4. He's 8 years old, lighten up, man. A couple of months ago, this guy came over, he had done a fifth step on Wednesday night, he was coming over to finish it Thursday night, and Jesse's doing homework, and the guy walks in, Jesse doesn't even look up, he says, what's the matter, dude? Blew it last night, gotta do it again? My older son did something pretty dangerous a couple of weeks ago, and I got right up in his face and I chewed him out. I chewed him out because I had to impress upon him what he had done was very dangerous and it could not happen again. And he walked away from me and he slammed the door to his room. So I walked in to the room and I went like this, and he went, you know what? I didn't tell you you were wrong. Don't tell me I can't get angry. You were right about what you said up there, but I just had a big man get up in my face and chew me out. Don't you think you'd be mad? You're not wrong. I'm mad. Don't tell me I can't be mad. What have you done to us? It's a story I'm fond of telling. I try to tell it every time I share. It was the first time I really knew that my son was really getting better. Because I didn't know if he ever would. I really didn't know if he ever would. Some years ago, I was making them lunch, and I said to Mike, what do you want on your hot dog? And he said, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. And I said, lettuce? He said, yeah, I don't want lettuce. And he walked away, and he came back about 45 minutes later, and he looked at me directly in the eyes, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. So I asked him to sponsor me at that point. What is that? Where does that come from? A couple of weeks ago, Jesse said to me, Dad, does your pubic hair get gray when you get older? I said, yeah. He said, well, does it make... What's that got to do with sobriety, right? Tell you what it's got to do. We're having a great time. My kids aren't scared of me. 8.5 years ago when I reached across my dinner table and my arm came near my children, they flinched. My children aren't scared of me anymore. My wife is terrified of me. I'll give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, Nancy said, you got to take Mike to the dentist. It's her older son. And I said, oh, I have to take him? Where will you be? She said, well, I'll be in the house dancing around naked screaming, I'm not taking him, I'm not taking him.
can understand why I won't be complaining about my pants when I get home. I won't be bringing it up at all. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only text about recovery from a fatal illness that contains the sentence, "We absolutely insist on enjoying life." There's no book about cholera that says, "Cholera's a hoot." It's a hoot. You'll love cholera. You'll meet other people with cholera. You'll have a great time with them. And then you'll meet people who just got cholera, and it doesn't get any better than that. Dr. Paul is fond of saying, and I love when he says it, he says, this is the only illness that the recovery of which will leave you in actually in better condition than you were in before you contracted it. That's a pretty remarkable statement. Yeah. If you're new here, I'm going to say to you the weirdest thing they ever said to me. When you want to drink, don't. Man, that is pretty. No one had ever said, they said a lot of stuff, but they never said it. Don't. Now, the not drinking part's hard. If it wasn't for the not drinking part, we'd be a much bigger organization. Our ranks would swell, you know, if it wasn't for the non-drinking part. Because, you know, a lot of people want our deal. We're a pretty popular club, you know, and that's why AA gets diffuse. And there's so many people like the people who organize this conference and so many other people who are so focused on keeping our primary purpose alive and well and functioning. And you can even go to a meeting and hear about it. That's always a unique experience and something that I enjoy tremendously. If you're new here, what we're going to suggest to you is that you've been treating your own alcoholism and your treatment is an absolute failure. No one has ever gotten better from anything using your treatment and the numbers are dwindling. We're going to put forward to you that we have a treatment for alcoholism that really, really works. It takes longer, but it really, really works. So when you want to drink, don't use your treatment. Use ours. Call us. Don't drink no matter what. You can't get sober without a spiritual awakening. We know you haven't had it yet. Don't drink till you have it. It's weird, but that's why we say don't drink no matter what. That's why we say call us. That's why we say crawl on your belly. Do anything you can do. Don't drink. Don't drink. It'll mess up your sobriety. And I needed to hear this. I needed to hear it. I love that Al-Anon skit the other day where this woman had every problem in the world except her problem. You know? Alcohol is but a symptom. Well, if I don't take care of a symptom, I'm probably not going to get to the disease. I am so honored and so moved that you would want a Jewish kid from the Bronx to come and talk to people in Montana about alcoholism. I'm sorry about my pants. Thanks for letting me share.